Israeli forces have raided a Palestinian village home to a man who has shot several Israelis in Tel Aviv. The forces clashed with residents and arrested members of the man's family. The 26-year-old Palestinian man gunned down five Israelis, including a military officer, in a suburb of Tel Aviv on Tuesday. Resistance groups regard the attack a natural response and a heroic operation retaliation for the crimes committed by the Tel Aviv regime. In recent weeks, more and more Palestinians in different parts of the occupied territories have been targeted by Israeli forces. There have also been several attacks on Palestinians in the Negev by unknown Jewish groups. Now, what's next for Palestinians? What option do they have to deal with the violence and treason of some Arab states?
A natural and legitimate response to Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. This is how Palestinian resistance groups praised the deadly shooting spree that left five Israelis dead in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox city of Bnei Barak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, on Tuesday night. The operation was carried out by 27-year-old Diya Hamarshi from Yabad town near Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Hamarshi was shot dead during the clashes. Both resistance groups, Hamas and al-Jihad, in addition to other Palestinian factions, had welcomed the incident.
These operations are part of the Palestinian people's struggle and resistance. We are speaking about an increase of operations and acts against the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. In one way or another, it's related to the fighting status and last year's Sword of Al-Quds battle. But also, there are numerous factors that naturally lead to counter-violence used by Israel. Provocations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the settlement activity, and settlers' aggression, discrimination, and violence against Palestinians in lands occupied in 1948.
Israeli military decided to bolster its troops in the occupied West Bank and border areas with four additional battalions. In addition, two battalions will be sent to reinforce troops in the Gaza Strip envelope area. Israeli forces raided Yabad town and stormed Hamarshi's home. Large crowds gathered and clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. Hamarshi's family members were questioned, and at least 30 Palestinians were detained in Yabad and other areas.
Israel is threatening to do what it's already doing, which is oppression of the Palestinian people and continuation of occupation and the apartheid racial system of discrimination. Any more escalation will only complicate the situation more. What should be clear here, especially after the Negev meeting, that nobody can marginalize the Palestinian issue, and that the Palestinian issue is the central issue of this region.
Tuesday's operation marked the third deadly operation in lands occupied in 1948 in Israel in a week, bringing the combined death toll to 11 Israelis, excluding Palestinian perpetrators. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett vowed that Israel will fight what he described as terrorism with an iron fist. Israeli military officials warned that Tel Aviv's shooting and the recent operations in Umm al-Fahm and Bir al-Sabah could lead to copycat attacks. Palestinians, however, reiterate that such incidents are a normal response to Israeli crimes and violence in the occupied territories. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our panelists in today's episode of Spotlight. Richard Becker, anti-war activist with the Answer Coalition, and also the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, out of San Francisco. Also joining us will be Khaled Barakat, journalist and activist in Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. My first question for Richard. In your opinion, Richard, what's responsible for this rising violence and escalation that have been witnessing recently in the occupied territories?
Well, you know, the way that the media reports in the United States is that violence only takes place when there are acts of resistance by Palestinians. But every day, the violence is going on against the Palestinian people in the West Bank. Gaza, of course, a giant open-air prison with really declining, steadily declining living standards for the people who live there. But every day, the settlers and the occupation forces in the West Bank carry out acts of brutality and often murder against Palestinians. But that doesn't show up in the media in the United States. And of course, It is the oppression, this long-term oppression and repression of the Palestinian people, which is going to bring about all kinds of resistance, some of it in an organized way by organizations, some of it individual acts. It's impossible to have the situation go on the way that it is now and the way that it has been for many years and many decades and not see all kinds of acts of resistance take place.
Now let me turn to Vancouver. Khaled, the Palestinian assailants and even some who pose no threat, they get gunned down by Israeli forces regularly. But how come their homes come under attack? I mean, why are their family members arrested?
Well, this is a practice that Israel do on a daily basis, and that it's the collective punishment. When they arrest a Palestinian, they made sure to terrorize the entire neighborhood and the village. And this is a daily life of Palestinians under occupation for the past 74 years. So it's, and we don't want to get used to it. We are going to resist that. The natural thing for Palestinians is to actually resist occupation, resist colonization and apartheid. And, these escalations that they are talking about is happening inside 1948 occupied territories, or what they call Israel, which means that the Israelis are witnessing also a new phenomena. They cannot have a free hand in oppressing our people inside Israel the same way they do in the West Bank and Gaza. Last May, Israel killed over 500 Palestinians in Gaza with U.S.-made weapons, and the world was silent. And for Palestinians to resist that, it becomes, a concern by the United States. Actually, the U.S. is responsible on Israel crimes and what Israel is doing, and they're providing not just the military and political supports for them, but as Richard mentioned, they are absolutely fabricating these stories and lies in U.S. media. And that's something also we know why they do that. But absolutely, we are going to witness a rise in the Palestinian resistance, especially in the holy month of Ramadan. And Israel now needs to understand that they cannot keep confiscating Palestinian lands and demolishing their homes and then expect Palestinians to be silenced. The other issue is the political issue in the region. When this, the shame of summit that happened in Naqab, where Arab reactionary regimes and Israel are meeting in Palestine to declare basically a coalition. That's not normalization. Okay. That's building a
Khaled,
coalition.
We'll come to that later in the show. Okay. Now let me go to Richard and ask him this question. Richard, resistance movements regard attacks like the one that we're discussing today as a natural response to the Israeli crimes committed against them. Do you agree?
Well, when you actually witness, and I have just very briefly been able to witness, the kind of day-to-day brutality against the population, against the Palestinians, and as Khaled says, inside 48, there is resistance and oppression as well. But when you see the situation, you actually see it. I mean, I think most people who go from the United States, and even if they think they have an understanding of how bad it is, and the apartheid regime, and the police and settler repression, and so forth. No one can really grasp it until you see it, and of course, you can't really grasp it until you live it. But when you see it, it's just shocking, the level of brutality against the Palestinian population at the hands of the Israeli military, and even more so at the hands of the settlers. And the way that the reactions are by the authorities there, like there's just a story in the media from there a few days ago about how a man is assaulted by Israeli settlers, five or six of them. He's beaten, and he fights back, and then he's arrested, and the settlers are let go. This is a day-to-day, I am not exaggerating, when the attacks by the settlers take place, these fascist settlers, and I use the word fascist advisedly, these fascist settlers, they chop down the olive trees, they assault people, they attack their homes, they attack people in cars, and the Israeli military, which is right there, either does nothing or joins with the settlers in the attack. So what do we think the population, how the population is going to respond to that?
Okay, Khaled, in multiple areas in the occupied lands, Palestinians these days feel more insecure, like Palestinians living in the Negev region. And they're concerned about, you know, Jewish vigilante groups there. For instance, we have this Battle Rangers unit that's a civilian group launched by a former Israeli police officer who is claiming inadequate police governance in the southern region. So why should Tel Aviv allow such radical elements to threaten Palestinian lives? As an occupier, they're responsible for the security of those people, aren't they?
Absolutely, but Israel do that all the time. I mean, it was established by these militias, Zionist, you know, criminals, militias, and they kept, you know, the settlers, they're all armed. So the settlers are actually paramilitary kind of part of the security, part of Israel military presence in Palestine. And so when you see a colony or an Israeli settlement, this is not just, you know, people who are living there. They have like weapon storage rooms, they have military compounds, they have weapons. These are not, you know, neighborhoods, as Israel tried to put it, but it's actually a military compound. In fact, when they arrest Palestinians, sometimes they take them to these settlements first as, you know, a station on the road to prison. So Israel does that not just in the West Bank. It also do that in 1948 areas, and particularly in Naqab, because also they want to oppress Palestinians without having any legal charges or accountability. At the same time, what Israel is doing in the Naqab is being not just the state oppressing the Bedouins and the Arabs, Palestinian Arabs in the Naqab, but it also institutions like the Jewish National Fund, who is funding these programs, and who is also trying to put a humanitarian face on the so-called development of the Naqab, when in fact what they're doing is confiscating Palestinian land. And the vast majority of this land, by the way, is owned by its original owners, are refugees in Gaza. These are people who were uprooted from their, you know, villages in the Naqab. And the Palestinian people are united today, actually, more than any other time in their history. Yes, maybe there is probably differences between Palestinian political parties, but as far as Palestinian people are concerned, they are united. We have seen this last May when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians across Palestine and in the Shatat, in diaspora, went out in the streets calling for escalating for Palestinian resistance, chanting for Palestinian resistance, and that Palestine will be free from the river to the sea.
Now, Richard, to make matters worse, as Khaled also mentioned a short while ago, recently there was a summit held between Tel Aviv and foreign ministers of Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, and the UAE. You know, they just recently signed that normalization deal, and that drew the ire of Palestinians. So what makes these states stand by Palestinians' enemies?
Well, you know, on one hand, we should be glad to see them actually come out in the open and reveal the reality of the opposition that the Palestinians have faced for so many decades. And that is that they not only are fighting against Zionism and Israel taking over the land and U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, but also the reactionary Arab regimes, and who have pretended to be supporters of the Palestinians, who for a long time gave money in some cases or other forms of support in the hopes that that would ensure their reputations against their own population. And the population of all of these countries is not in favor of the Arab countries I'm talking about, who are being drawn into this through the Abraham Accords, as it's called, and so forth. Right. The people aren't in favor of this. The people are against it. The people sympathize with the Palestinians. But the rulers of these extremely undemocratic states, like, you know, the Kingdom of Morocco and United Arab Emirates, where only 11% of the population is allowed to be citizens, or Saudi Arabia, that just beheaded 81 of its 81 people on the same day on March 12th. These are extremely reactionary governments that are proclaimed in the United States to be our friends and, you know, those who are standing for democracy. Well, they're not standing for democracy, and they're opposed to the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause, because they know how central the Palestinian cause is to the cause of the Arab people throughout the Arab nation and throughout the Arab world. And that this can bring, you know, that a victory for the Palestinians would be a victory for all. And so they are very fearful. These governments are very fearful.
Mm-hmm. Khaled, well, you raised the issue, so let me ask you this question. The Arab leaders who signed the so-called normalization deals with Tel Aviv, they believe that a two-state solution should be implemented with the Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem as its capital. Is that the solution?
No, this is not the solution. In fact, they don't even believe it themselves. I mean, regardless of how rotten this so-called two-state solution is, but they don't even believe that. What they're doing now in the region is these Arab reactionary regimes and Israel are forming an alliance under the auspices and the care of the United States and, you know, U.S. imperialism. This camp is fighting another camp in the region, because this is just the reality. The region is divided into two camps. One that is pro-Zionism, colonization, these regimes who wants to maintain their power and their authority, and they are undemocratic regimes. They want to maintain their power. And there are another camp in the region, and that is the people's camp, the popular camp, and also a resistance camp. And in this camp, it's Iran, Hezbollah, the Palestinian resistance, the popular movements, the student movements, the anti-normalization movements. And as Richard mentioned, you know, the last polls, even there's by the account of their own, you know, centers, over 80% of Arab youth even reject normalization. So we know that this is a conflict, and it's part of also an international conflict, and we see how this is played. Palestine is in the center of this.
Okay, Richard, let's also hear your opinion on the two-state solution.
Well, the solution is the right of the Palestinian people. What solution there will be is the right of the Palestinian people to determine. You know, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people, but we do not, from inside the United States, pretend to give advice to the Palestinians on what to do. But I think that it's, if you look, just look at a map, and you look at a map of the West Bank, and you see the vast encroachment of settlements, you have to, and the complete separation of Gaza. You know that the Israelis don't have any intention of granting anything like that. But what would it be on this point? It would require the dismantling of the settlements. And then if such a state came into being, which was discussed, the conditions that Israel always has insisted upon, fully backed by the United States, is that it would have to be a demilitarized zone, demilitarized state in which Israel continued to control the airspace and the water resources and the borders. In other words, it would be a neo-colony. If any kind of two-state that has been put forward in the past would amount to that. But again, I want to emphasize that for those of us inside the United States, far away, we do not pretend to tell the Palestinians what the outcome of their struggle should be.
Okay. And Khaled, one last question. Given the circumstances, what, in your opinion, is the best approach for the Palestinians to adopt?
Palestinians are actually realizing that the so-called peace process path have failed. The last 30 years have been really miserable for Palestinians because they saw that Israel have engaged in a so-called peace process, and at the same time they were committing their crimes on a, you know, business as usual, confiscating Palestinian lands, saying Palestinians have no right to return to their homes, and they're using this whole scheme of peace process to actually slaughter and end and liquidate the Palestinian people right. And now more and more Palestinians are realizing that an alternative revolutionary path is due, and that Palestinians are engaged in this path, and that is the path of liberation and return. And this would also be the bridge of a secular democratic Palestine where everyone can enjoy equal rights, but under the sovereignty of the Palestinian people.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and input. Richard Becker in San Francisco, Khaled Barakat in Vancouver. And thank you. I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, working and employment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of working and employment in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at these societies, we see that people generally are looking for a better job. And when we ask them, what do you mean by a better job? They say that the job that will give us more returns. For example, it has a high salary, the facilities, maybe they are much more. And on the other hand, when we talk about the work, that how much should be work, so they try to have least work with the most income. And that is the criteria, unfortunately, in today's world. And when we look at the families, when we look at the youth in the universities, and generally when we ask them why you are studying this field or this subject, the general answer is given that this will have in future a better income. This will provide me a better income in the future. And I'm, for example, becoming the engineer, I'm becoming a philosopher, for example, or any profession that they choose, studying the politics and anything else. It is just because they're looking at the earning perspective of the studies. If someone is becoming a lawyer, he's not becoming a lawyer to help people. This is something which is in his mind, but the main thing is that how can I maximize my income and which profession will provide me the maximum income and I can have a better life in the financial terms. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of working and employment. We said that unfortunately in today's world, we see that people are looking for a job that gives them more money and less work. And this is what the criteria is. And due to this, we can also see that sometimes people are studying something which does not match their nature. It's against their nature. But because this profession is said to be bringing more money in their life, this profession is supposed to be something that brings more happiness in terms of monetary in their life. That's why they're studying. And they do not look at their own perspective, like how they are and what they can do and what kind of talent do they have. Therefore, they choose something which is against their insight, which is against the talent that they have, and therefore they get busy in studying. Now, what happens is the problem is that the universities, the teachers, and the government, they all are spending some kind of investment on this person who has chosen a specific field of study which is against his nature and he does not have any talent in it. They spend all the time in it, and later when he comes out of that university without having a perfect talent, without having an inclined or a mood of working in that profession, he chooses forcefully to do that because it has a better income. And the place where he could better serve the community as of his own talents or his own nature or his, we can say, like the things that he loved to do, there we see lack of people. And that's why today we have unprofessional people more than the professionals in the world working in the societies. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For 8 years, Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine that did not accept the results of the Kyiv coup in 2014, has been under frequent shelling from national battalions and the armed forces of Ukraine. Residents of Donbas called it a war crime against the people, and from that moment Ukraine ceased to be a state in their eyes. According to Russian investigators, the actions of the Ukrainian military led to the deaths of more than 2,600 civilians, while more than 5,500 people were injured. 2,200 civilian infrastructure facilities were destroyed.
This is a town, a school number 50 of the sadly known town of Gorlovka in the Donbas region, which is being shelled regularly.
The last time it was shelled by Ukrainian artillery on 24th of February, the teachers died on the spot. But one of the heaviest recent shellings, hushed up by the Western media, happened on March 14 in Donetsk. The Ukrainian military hit the center of the city with a Tochka-U tactical missile equipped with a cluster warhead. The rocket was shot down, but due to the fall of debris, 23 people died and 18 were injured.
The special operation of Russia is our opportunity to defend ourselves, the possibility that the Donbas will not be destroyed and hundreds of thousands of civilians will not be lost due to the Ukrainian aggression. We will be able to remain ourselves. We will be able to speak Russian, our native language, with which we were born and studied. We will have the right to relate to the history and results of the great patriotic war without manipulation. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers can be considered the winners against fascism and in no other way. Thanks to Russia's special operation, joy and hope for a just future appeared in the Donbas.
The ultimate goal of our republic is to hold a referendum in which the people exercise their constitutional right and express their opinion on joining the Russian Federation. I'm sure that's exactly what will happen. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Luhansk Republic have been living for 8 years under constant shelling and being in an economic and political blockade, experiencing the mockery and horrors of the Nazi battalions of Ukraine. They felt support only from the Russian Federation. With hope and a dream in our hearts, we are waiting for the opportunity to become part of the Russian Federation, to return, as they said in the Crimea, to our native harbour and start working on a great future.
The emotional answer of the head of the LPR to Press TV about holding a referendum on joining Russia caused a wide response. Later he explained that the main task facing the leadership of the LPR now is the completion of hostilities. According to him, the battalions of Ukrainian nationalists are responsible for the murder, torture, robbery and rape of civilians in Donbas. Most of them are relied on the experience of the commanders of the SS division during the World War II, and here in the settlement of Trehizbionka, still terrified. People did not believe in liberation and whispered about how they were bullied and subjected to violence. Here, the LPR servicemen found torture chambers with Nazi symbols hung up and the remains of those who simply disappeared from the village one day without a trace. The documents and an armaments depot were left by terrorist organization Right Sector. The LDPR military and People's Militia say they collected documents about cases of cruelty against the population of Donbas and people from other regions of Ukraine. The documents include photos of people killed by bombing, runic symbols and signs of national battalions, facts of war crimes against humanity, and the positions of battalions in settlements with caches of weapons of mass destruction. Numerous residents of the recently liberated Volnovakha told Press TV that when the Russian forces entered their town, Ukrainian battalions left all the civilian property destroyed. Residents of the city were forbidden to evacuate, and looting had begun.
I am the chief physician of the Volnovakha District Hospital. This is what is left. This is our outpatient polyclinic building. We were in the basements. We all worked and provided assistance to the victims. Our employee died during a shelling from the Ukrainian side. Only on March 13, we were able to get out. There were heavy weapons of the Ukrainian forces on the territory of our hospital. All international conventions prohibit the presence of armed forces in civilian facilities. We asked them to leave the the hospital many times and were told that they were given the order to destroy it during retreat.
In Lugansk, servicemen showed tanks and heavy weapons left by Ukrainian militants in the liberated cities and towns. All captured grenade launchers and ammunition, armored personnel carriers, tanks and grenade launchers are productions of the UK, US, Turkey and NATO countries. Donbas leaders and citizens emphasize that the ongoing military operation of Russia was only a response to the criminal acts of Kyiv against Donbas as a timely and preemptive measure. Today, Moscow says it has documents with proof that Kyiv was preparing a large-scale attack and intended to destroy the DNR and LNR.
Russia says its aim over the past months has been to target Ukrainian military infrastructure to prevent the enemy from regrouping and reinforcing its presence in the Donbas. It says it will press ahead with a strategy until the whole region is liberated. Marina Kartunova, Lugansk region.
Peace will have no losers, and a prolonged conflict is not in anyone's interest. This is how Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan opened the face-to-face Russian-Ukrainian negotiations in Istanbul on Tuesday. Erdogan sounded optimistic as he assured Turkey's readiness to host a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents, whom both he referred to as valuable friends. A Ukrainian negotiator told reporters that they made a series of proposals during the talks to the Russian delegation, which included a demand from Ukraine to have 8 countries as guarantors, including Turkey. While Ukraine can guarantee not having foreign military bases, meaning it would not join military alliances. Ukraine's proposal also includes a 15-year consultation period on the status of annexed Crimea. However, it could only come into force in case of a complete ceasefire.
Ukraine wants to see 8 countries, including Turkey, the US, the UK, France and Germany, as guarantor states to legally actively protect Ukraine from any aggression.
Meanwhile, the Russian negotiator said they will convey Ukraine's suggestions to the Russian president, while describing the talks as constructive. Medinsky later said during the talks with the Ukrainian delegation that Russia is not against Ukraine joining the EU. The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by foreign ministers of the two countries.
Expect a ceasefire upon these meetings, negotiations, within days, maybe through this week, through the end of this week. But this might be a limited ceasefire. I mean, the Donbas region may be out of ceasefire, but at least there will be a positive step through ceasefire. The peace agreement will take some time. The questions are, problems are very big. Donbas and Crimea are something the leaders needed to discuss and agree.
The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by the foreign ministers of the two countries. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry announced a suspension of all operations around Kyiv and Chernihiv after the meeting. Today's meeting was considered constructive, as it will pave the way for deeper negotiations between the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Russia, and hopefully reaching an agreement on a complete ceasefire. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
In the aftermath of Yemen's blistering retaliatory strike on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities, crude oil prices shot up by over $120 a barrel. Yemen's military spokesperson revealed that the operation had been carried out in response to continued Saudi-led aggression.
Yemen will not hesitate to widen its military operation until the end of the aggression and breaking of the siege. Allah is witness to what we say.
With the threat of future attacks looming, many fear that Saudi's seemingly endless war on Yemen could negatively contribute to economic instability in Europe.
Now we are seeing it's affecting the pounds and the pennies. It's not just Britain. Look at the price of the gasoline and petrol in the United States, in Germany, everywhere else. everything is connected, you know, and I think the fact of the matter is, today's world, we can't commit these sort of atrocities on one side and think it's not going to come and bite us back later on. And now we are seeing very clear indication of direct impact on our pounds and pennies.
With the relationship between Russia and the West continuing to crumble, Riyadh hopes that it can use this opportunity and Europe's desperate need to replace Russian oil to its own advantage. However, with Yemen's ability to hit key Saudi oil infrastructure at will, serious questions are being raised about the reliability of Saudi as an oil-producing partner. Robert Carter, London.
Rights activists and families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons held a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli jails. Their show of solidarity comes as around 500 administrative detainees have been refusing to show up for their military court hearings for almost 3 months. Administrative detainees are incarcerated based on secret evidence without charge or trial for long periods of time.
This step by Palestinian administrative detainees is continue for around 86 days, protesting the administrative detention. And they insist to continue this step until they attain their demand of stopping or halting this illegal detention.
Palestinian prisoners, including women and children, as well as elderly prisoners, are kept in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers and are subjected to torture and psychological pressures by the Israeli prison authorities.
Today we are here to support the prisoners. Prisoners is our hero. We are to support prisoners and their families. We are continue to support them in all ways.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
We are here to support our prisoners. They are facing suffering in Israel J and their family, and to tell Red Cross to defend our prisoners. They are suffering with administrative detention and hunger strike.
Families of the prisoners say they will continue their weekly sit-ins until all Palestinian prisoners are set free.
People here consider Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters. Israel currently incarcerates around 5,000 Palestinians. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy. Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Andala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on Earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Andala's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali ha rappresentato
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Handala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On the banks of Kashmir's famous Dal Lake, surrounded by the majestic Zabarwan mountain range, Asia's largest tulip garden opens for visitors. 1.5 million flowers of 68 varieties have vibrantly colored the earth.
This is heaven and this place is beyond imagination. After facing lockdown for 2 years, this place is a treat.
Whatever is said in the media and shown is not the truth. The truth is, it is the most secure place to visit.
Kashmir is witnessing bumper tourist season this spring after COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Administration as well as people expect a bumper tourist season.
We are trying our best, and this year we are lucky in terms of early spring, so that people of Kashmir will have an economic boost.
Following the coronavirus pandemic, the tourists stopped visiting Kashmir, and last 2 years, Kashmir's economy faced a major setback.
Tourism is our backbone of our economy. The money they pump in our economy is manifold for our economy. So that's why our tourist, this tulip garden, it gives impetus to our tourist season. It prepones our tourist season. We have seen the initial response from tourists, particularly from outside UT. We are hoping that this season will be a great season for our tourism sector.
To reclaim the fractured economy, Kashmir's administration has organized a tulip festival to attract more tourists and locals so that the lockdown impact vanishes slowly to conflict-wrecked Kashmir.
After 2.5 years of continued closure due to COVID-19 pandemic, the opening of this garden has brought delight to the people of Kashmir, who for decades have suffered political instability and turmoil. Opening of such spaces helped boost morale and is a good start to a fresh year. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Following one of the largest retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of Yemen's capital Sana'a and other major cities to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The Yemeni people are free. 7 years of crime have passed against us, but this has been matched by 7 years of steadfastness, freedom and defeat of the enemy. The Yemeni army has manufactured weapons, including ballistic missiles and drones, and this is by the grace of God. And as Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, now a new phase of confrontation with the Saudi enemy will begin. Our big gathering today is to confirm that we will remain steadfast until we win and expel the occupier.
The protesters expressed their support for the army's recent aerial operations, saying the Saudis only understand the language of force and it is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense against Riyadh's war and siege.
All the Yemeni people are supporting the operations which has been against the Saudi facilities, economic facilities and also military facilities. We are revenging violations have been committed against the Yemeni people since March 2015, and we are very sure that we are now in the year of victory.
On Friday, the Yemeni army launched fresh attacks against several targets in Saudi Arabia. The attacks caused a heavy blow to Aramco's facilities in Jeddah, Jazan and Najran, as well as Ras Tanura and Rabigh refineries. The Yemeni army said it has also targeted vital sites in Riyadh with ballistic missiles.
People here say the eighth year of the war will be different, as the Yemeni army has already proven that it is capable of hitting Saudi targets, including its oil facilities. The Yemenis believe that Riyadh will eventually have to consider a political solution, at least to protect its oil giant Aramco in the face of Yemeni attacks. Abdulatif Alwashali, Sana'a.
France goes to the polls in just 2 weeks in an election marked by major disinterest and discontent over a lack of discussion on worsening domestic issues. Abstention is expected to reach 30%. The last time so few voters turned out was 2002, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it to the second round. Many wonder if this election, the surging left may stage a similar surprise, with Jean-Luc Mélenchon now approaching the far-right's Marine Le Pen in the battle to make it past the first round. The so-called bourgeois bloc of voters is highly motivated to win re-election for Emmanuel Macron, so he seems certain to make it to the final round. He has avoided debates and public appearances, preferring to focus on Ukraine, as his tenure has been marked by a record number of corruption scandals, economic inequality, and unprecedented political repression. In 2017, the two mainstream political parties, dogged by corruption scandals, were ousted for the first time since Charles de Gaulle. In 2012, optimism was sky high that François Hollande was going to end austerity and stand up to Berlin and Brussels. But in this election, France, a rare Western country known for high levels of political engagement, appears to be exhausted by politics. A vast and intimidating police presence at demonstrations won't encourage political gatherings either.
Everyone here can feel the intimidation towards the yellow vests. Look at how cops are surrounding us before we even start. We're the only protesters who get treated like this, except for neo-Nazi rallies. But we aren't neo-Nazis or a political party. We're simply the people.
Unions have just pulled out their big gun, an unlimited strike for Paris public transport. That strike has confusingly been stopped after just one day, perhaps showing that France remains in a state of confusion even so close to the election.
France has only just ended its coronavirus restrictions, and the lack of political interest appears to show that the country hasn't really gotten back to normal. Western polls have been notoriously inaccurate, however, and sky-high inflation may play a crucial part when voters decide about the next 5 years. Rahman Mazahiri, Paris.
Nowruz in Travelogues. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has impacted foreign travelers and tourists so deeply that many of them have prepared accounts on what they had seen in Iran during this ancient feast. As it was said in the previous episode, many of these foreigners were politicians and spies who have registered their experiences of Nowruz in Iran in order to get familiar with every minute custom among Iranians. This has been done to pave the way for cultural colonialism. Today, we are going to touch upon the accounts of some other foreigners who have ridden on Nowruz in Iran. Stay tuned, please. Thank you. Among various sources on Nowruz in Iran, the book, at the presence of Sultan Sahib Qaran, more descriptively deals with this issue. The writer of the book is Heinrich Karl Brusch, German traveler of the 19th century. He has registered his findings on Nowruz during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar, known as Sultan Sahib Qaran. He writes, Nowruz feast was near. The word Nowruz is for almost all Iranians a magic and miraculous word. With hearing the word, the hearts beat and faces smile, and in the hope of a better future in the coming Nowruz, they tolerate all their present hardships and problems, and they wish for the coming of Nowruz in the whole year. Brusch has pointed to the long history of Nowruz. He continues, Nowruz coincides with the end of winter and the turn of zodiac pieces and a start of spring. The prevalence of astrology and astronomy during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah Qajar had attracted the German traveler, as he writes elsewhere in his book. Iranian astronomers look for auspicious and inauspicious hours and get good wages by determining these hours for the king and princes. From a few days before Nowruz, they try to determine the time of the sun's turn to pieces with the exactness of seconds and announce it to enable people to do their traditional ceremonies. German traveler of the 19th century, Heinrich Karl Brusch, writes in his accounts on Nowruz, confectionaries have prospered and they supply different kinds of original Iranian sweets. This traveler continues, for Nowruz feast, Iranians usually grow flowers in their small homes or vases, which begin with the letter S, including sumbul, meaning hyacinth. This way, they celebrate the awakening of the nature after a long winter sleep. Brusch narrates on the Qajarid king's presence in Buzar before Nowruz, writing, as the king intended to go to bazaar, Sabze Meydan Square would be cordoned off and nobody was allowed to enter. Only the Shah's entourage and courtiers were allowed to enter. The book of the German traveler says that the two kinds of greetings, namely the minor greeting and the public greeting, were among the requirements of Nowruz. Minor greeting belonged to family and relatives and was done on the 1st of Farvardin, in the interior of royal citadel. But public greeting was done differently. The Shah would sit on the throne at the porch of the tall palace, looming over the large yard near the square so that he could see everyone in the large yard. This porch had long and large curtains which would be drawn away. The participants of the public greeting, including officers, high-ranking officials, the nobility, clergymen, VIPs, and princes, who would line up in different places which had already been determined to see the Shah with pomp and glory. British diplomat Robert Kerr Porter, some 200 years ago, had traveled to Iran. He writes in 1819 on what he had seen in Tehran during Nowruz. I arrived in Arg Square on the first day of Nowruz feast. People were there from every group and class. After the entrance door, I entered the interior of Arg, where the Shah would receive his subjects. After a while, I was in the enclosure of the palace. The Shah came and sat on the throne. The attending nobility congratulated him and received their gift, and the ceremony was ended. Karsten Neipur was a German tourist and cartographer who traveled to Iran during the Zandia rule. He was one of the few travelers who have written unbiased accounts on Iranian customs and traditions. Neipur writes in 1765, "On March 19th, I was drawing at home. Villagers thought that I was making preparations for Nowruz feast. The Iranian Nowruz is the day that has existed in the ancient era." The German tourist continues, "On March 20th, corresponding with Farvardin I, villagers had put on better clothes and they didn't work on this day. Wearing better clothes and not working were the only things that this day was a feast, and since it was